It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past two decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 75 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, true crime producer with 23 years in the business, along with my bestie, woman who's dressing up as a functional member of society for Halloween this year, Melissa Spivey.
That would be major costume. I don't know if I could handle that. Extreme cosplay.
Seriously. Well, Melissa, it is time to wrap up our October block, which we are calling Cursed by the Past, where we explore crimes which left a lasting impression on the sites where said crimes occurred. And we had the Todville Murder Mansion, sometimes referred to as Seabrook Murder Mansion. Mm-hmm. And we also examined the atrocities that went on at the Dozier School in Marianna, Florida. And then last week, we went to the epicenter of all things spooky, Salem, Massachusetts, to bring you the senseless murder of Martha Brailsford in 1991. And those two cases, Todville and Dozier, they were plucked from a book, Haunted Crime Scenes, Paranormal Evidence from Crimes and Crime Scenes Across the USA, by the amazing Catherine Ramsland and Mark Nesbitt.
I'm so excited for today. I've been waiting for this day.
Well, I'm going to ask you not to fangirl too hard when I introduce this guest. Do you think you can handle that?
I think that I cannot. And I think that you should know better by now. I can't control myself. But I have my inhaler, so we should be good.
Oh, good. Well, you better control yourself because this could be the first and last appearance then. So. Well, our guest tonight is someone who spent her career standing at the crossroads of science and shadow. She's a psychologist, a professor, an author of dozens of books exploring the darkest corners of the human mind, from serial killers to criminal profiling to the mysteries of the paranormal. She's written about vampires, forensic psychology, haunted crime scenes, and one of the most infamous killers of the modern era, Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, with whom she worked directly with to document his crimes and the psychology behind them. And more recently, one of her books, which she co-wrote with another friend of mine, Tracy Ullman, called The Serial Killer's Apprentice, has turned into a documentary and became the number one movie on HBO Max. So you will definitely want to check that out. So dim the lights, sharpen your instincts, and join us as we welcome to Murder Unscripted, the queen of creeptastic stories, Dr. Catherine Ramsland.
Hi, great introduction.
How was that for an intro, right? It's like when they had to introduce Apollo Creed and he was like, "Ugh, okay." Well, Catherine, before we get started, I do need to let you know that this is an absolute dream come true for Melissa. Not that it's not for me, but I've already met you. So I had to listen to her rave about you and your work for months now, ever since you agreed to be on. So this is
I'm so excited. That's the only reason I've kept my friendship with Ed. I've been using him this whole time.
It's true. Well, you have done countless interviews and every true crime fan I know is familiar with your work, but I'm hoping to bring our audience a little more personal perspective, like a look at your life, your career. So if you're up for it, I want to go back to the very beginning. And you obviously have been a PA resident for quite some time, but you're actually born in Michigan, right?
I was born in Michigan and I left there when I was 18 to hitchhike across the country. And when I was 19, I rode a motorcycle across the country and stayed out west for quite a while. I ended up going back to school, though I said I would never, ever enter a classroom after high school. And now I have, five graduate degrees. So
I think I saw a picture of that little motorcycle. You posted it on Facebook not that long ago of that motorcycle you were on. It was so cool.
Yeah, I had a great time. It was a wonderful trip. And I was always very adventurous. And it's so no surprise, I guess, that I went into the vampire subculture. And I wrote a bunch of books with Anne Rice involving her supernatural universe, Dean Koontz's biography. And I actually never aspired to be a writer, but these things came my way and I've made the most of it. And now I'm in the field and the world of forensic psychology and science.
Yes, you are. Well, before we get into that, can you tell us about, I don't know if you've ever talked about your family in your early life.
They would not like me to do so. I mean, I can say this. You, my mother put ghost stories into my hands when I was a little kid. I mean, she was very much into that. So mm-hmm. I would certainly thank her for that life direction. But my family is fairly private.
So do you feel like that those ghost stories kind of started your fascination with death? And did it lead to an interest in psychology?
My life has been very circuitous. I've gone around with so many different things. I would say that it was philosophy first. That was my okay. first major was philosophy, but then I got a double major in psychology and a master's in psychology, but then I got a PhD in philosophy and then forensic psychology and then criminal justice. And recently I got an MFA. So that's wow. that's kind of how I follow my interests. And I wouldn't say I'm primarily interested in psychology because I think philosophy is just as strong as all mm-hmm. of that. And writing, you know, really dominates. Most of my opportunities have come through writing, the fact that I'm a writer.
Wow. So what do you think kind of made you realize you wanted to explore kind of the darker side of human behavior?
You know, I don't solve my own mysteries because mm-hmm. I think that's partly the fuel of my passions and my momentum. So I kind of don't dissect, you know, why am I interested in this or that? I mean, I have dark history. You know, I have some murders in my family, yeah, not my immediate family, but, you know, my ancestry. I have, wow. people who are interested in the occult, etc. So I think it just sort of, you know, came through people that I grew up with who were interested in it. But I don't really spend a lot of time. Why did I go this way? I just would rather do that. The couple of times that I've tried writing books that were more on the light side of things, it's just so boring.
Yeah.
You know, they were hard to write because I didn't really care.
Well, I was just wondering, because it doesn't seem like you would choose your path going into it with the idea that you're going to start to dissect serial killers and what makes them tick.
Yeah, I never wanted to do that. It was never something that I set out to do. I don't think I chose my path as much as the path formed and I took it, because I had, you know, it was early in the whole true crime industry. I was getting my degree. I was working with John Douglas, the FBI mm-hmm. profiler, research for his book around the same time that I was at John Jay College for the forensic psychology program, and started talking to serial killers and started writing for the Court TV website with that. And that wasn't even a choice. I wrote for a small website called the Crime Library when the mm-hmm. internet was just getting going. And she had made three stories. So I said, I'll write some. And then all of a sudden Court TV bought them and I was writing for Court TV. And so it isn't like I chose my path. It's more like the path was in front of me and I jumped for it. And it formed my career in a way that I didn't aspire to, and yet I made the most of it.
Sure. And it's interesting because when I had met you, I think you were doing forensic files before I came on. So you were kind of what we described over the years we've come to know as ringers, someone who would like offer your expertise on a case. You'd review a case that maybe you weren't attached to and just weigh in on some of the things. So how did that come about? Was it the ties to Crime Library and Court TV that got you hooked up with forensic files?
Well, I've kind of always understood that in a way it was because I was a blonde woman. Which I think sounds very odd, but I remember camera people at some of the earliest documentaries I did telling me we picked you because you're just a surprise. People aren't expecting this petite blonde
really?
Woman to be talking about vampires and talking about serial killers and
I love that.
It's kind of true.
I kind of think it wasn't because I was so brilliant. I think it was because I was, you know, something different for their camera work. And as more and more opportunities came my way, I became more and more of an expert. But certainly initially, I think it was really more that I was just unusual. And it wasn't typical to have women in this field. Now it is a lot more so, but it wasn't when I started.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. And in particular, someone who just looks like, you know, I should be a cheerleader or something, I guess. I really never knew what they meant. I remember an editor picking me for a book called Cemetery Stories because I was little and unintimidating.
And interesting.
You know, for me, bring it, you know, I'll do the work because I don't care how I got the opportunity. I will prove myself when I'm doing the work. And that's what I have done for most of my career. But if somebody says they picked me for a reason other than my, you know, what I would want them to pick me for, it doesn't matter because I can make the most of it.
As fellow eye candy, I get it. I mean, I just understand.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it was unique back when I started. And I think, you know, just sort of, you know, you'd have to tell me why do people keep calling me. I don't know why.
I mean, is there anything at this point that you've worked so many complex cases? Like, is there something that continues to fascinate you about the criminal mind? I think you've seen it all at this point.
I've seen it all, but I guess I haven't seen it all. I mean, I wouldn't want to think that I have seen it all, but I've seen a lot. People are always asking me what surprises me, and nothing. What people are capable of can horrify me. It won't surprise me. But I still like reading really twisty cases because I'm always interested in how did that person become that way? And the more unusual, you know, the more interesting their story. And there's always going to be stuff, you know, circumstances in people's lives that I've never heard of. And, you know, so I stay with it because I keep getting I keep getting really interesting stories that now I want to dig deeper. It intrigues me. You know, like I recently was watching a documentary on Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Unabomber.
You know, we've gone over that ground and over that ground and over that ground. But I started reading a book by one of his neighbors who was a little girl. And wow, is that an interesting perspective? Something I hadn't really thought of. And her coming to terms with how could this guy who gave me gifts that he made turn out to have been this just nasty, irascible person who hated everybody. So that was a whole new way to look at him. And I'm finding that I like going at it through angles. Like Ted Bundy's cousin recently wrote a memoir, and that was really interesting because she gave us a perspective. She filled in some holes that we've often wondered about. And not that we now know everything, we don't, but she gave us a little bit more. So for me, even if I know a case really well, if somebody has something more to say, most of the cases I know really well will still have mystery to them. We'll still have something that we need to know. And so it keeps me, you know, moving into this arena.
Well, Catherine, one of the things that has always fascinated me about you is how you made the leap from exploring the criminal mind to paranormal forensics. So if you could first explain what that term even means, and kind of tell us what first sparked your interest in the otherworldly. Was there a case or something spooky happened to you that kind of jump-started this angle?
No, it's the ghost came first. I mean, that's something from my childhood. I've always loved ghost stories. People in my family claim to have seen ghosts. I consider myself a ghost repellent because when I'm there, they're not.
Oh.
So either they're not real or they are avoiding me. So I don't know. But, you know, I keep getting mediums telling me things like, you're surrounded by serial killer ghosts and the other ghosts don't want to be near you. You know, so that's one explanation, I guess. Or they're talking to you but you can't hear them, whatever. If you can move things, then you can move things when I ask you to.
True.
If there's and I've re recently written a crime fiction series of four novels where Annie Hunter is a forensic psychologist who takes on hard nuts to crack. So her investigation agency is the Nutcracker Investigations, and she takes on paranormal cases like I do. But she, like me, it is needs to see some proof and needs to make sense of this
Same.
world. Like
Yep.
she'll have in the first book, Ice Cream Man, which actually came from a real ghost story, which we might talk about along the way, came from a real weird encounter. But if she's being drawn into a case because there's this ghostly presence, and then she's right at the grave that he wants her to see, but where is he? Like if you can talk to me in some seance, you can stand here at the grave and tell me if this is the right place. So that's how I am. That's how she is. And so all of her attitudes about it come directly from me.
We touched on this in a previous episode because it was like, is there a scientific reason that people feel haunted?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes. I wrote a book called Ghost Investigating the Other Side. That's probably the first real ghost book I wrote, and that came right out of, first I went undercover in the vampire subculture for 2 years, and I acquired a supposedly haunted ring, and so that took me into the ghost hunter subculture, where I did all kinds of things and stayed in many haunted places overnight, like Lizzie Borden's house. Did a lot of stuff like that, and asked all these questions. And I did find research that shows that certain areas of our brain will give us a sense that there's a person, that we'll even see an apparition-like person with certain types of brain stimulation. So it could be some projective thing from the brain. However, I collect stories from many different types of people. Often they say, "I don't believe in ghosts, but this happened." And if you have different people saying the same thing about a place, but they don't know one another, that's got to be taken seriously. I mean, I know people constantly say to me, if you're in the field of science, how can you believe in ghosts? And it isn't that I believe in ghosts, it's that I'm very curious. If you're a true scientist, you are moving toward your curiosity. You're setting up conditions to study it. You're going to try to find out. You're not going to just dismiss it because it doesn't fit with some materialistic philosophy. So I think the world's a richer place with ghosts in it, and I want to see one.
Completely agree.
I say that everywhere. I've lived in haunted places, and other people see these things, and I don't get to. Why not?
I agree. I'm like you. I need something. I'm so skeptical, but I want to believe. I want something to happen to me just so I can say, now it makes sense. Now I get it.
Exactly. And that keeps me going because there's always a new place to explore. There's always a new story or new tool that people that ghost hunters use to try out. And the paranormal forensics came from working with Mark Nesbitt. I would go to Gettysburg quite often. He was running the haunted crime or the Gettysburg ghost tours, and we got to be good friends. He's a character in Ghost. We got to be good friends, and we would do these haunted weekends at Gettysburg, and trying to figure out crime scenes and crimes that had happened. And so then I said, why don't we bring together this? You have paranormalists you work with and mediums and whatnot who claim that they can get ghosts to talk to them. So we have unsolved cases. So, for example, we started with the three girls in the that were laid out in the woods. Nobody knows who did this, but probably their father, who then went up the line and committed suicide. But we don't know why he did it, and there's many mysteries to the story. So, we come to a dead end forensically. Can the mediums give us something? Now, the problem is, if they can't give us something we can corroborate, then they can just make stuff up.
Sure, the
And
unexplained.
that's the frustrating part, is because if they're good storytellers, they can just make stuff up. That sounds good, But that doesn't mean
Sure.
it's true. So that's part of the issue for me and Annie Hunter, my character, is you can't just say all this stuff if we can't find this out. Like somebody, I remember being at a haunted vineyard once, and one of the mediums was saying, oh, you know, there's a murder here, and here's a stain on the floorboards that where it happened, and you know, it was during this time frame. I said, well, we can go look in their public records for somebody who died here. No, it was covered up. It was, you know. So to me, when someone does that, I'm not going to say bad words on
I
your
know, we
program,
know what
but
you're
you
getting
know
at.
What I
Yeah.
mean? Like, oh,
Yeah.
I can't stand that.
I
Don't
get
just
that.
make stuff up because you think, you know, your audience wants to hear it. But I will say I've had some, like the thing that got me writing about Annie Hunter was I was in working for Court TV. We were down in Savannah working on a haunted crime scene thing there. We're going to all kinds of places. And we went to one house called the Buzzard House. And it's not in Savannah proper, it's out in the country. And it was supposedly next to a house where Jim Williams from Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil had procured boys to take for these parties out in the woods. And we surmised that he had used Danny Hansford, the guy who was killed in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, the 20-year-old kid, that he had used Danny Hansford, another kid, to help with this trafficking. So that we were kind of looking into this investigatively. And we were in the Buzzard House, and a woman came up to me and said, her name was Sarah, she was a medium, and the ghost of Danny Hansford wanted to talk to me. Like,
wow.
Speak up.
Yeah.
But what was very interesting, and this is in, but it is in Paranormal Forensics and also in the first novel, Ice Cream Man. She said, he thinks you will understand because you know what this situation is. And she said, I'm hearing Candy Land or Candy Man. And I went, what?
I'm sorry, what?
Whoa.
Because
wow.
Dean Corll in Houston had used two boys to procure other boys. So it was a mirror to what we thought was going on there in Savannah. And I just went, what?
Wow.
So that became Ice Cream Man instead of Candy Man, Ice Cream Man. Like Ice Cream Man.
Mm-hmm.
Because it ended up becoming a whole trafficking situation. But I did say to this medium, should I contact Wayne Henley, Elmer Wayne Henley, who was in prison? He had killed Dean Corll, the serial killer. He's the only accomplice to kill the killer to end it. And he went to prison. He'd been in prison for, this is back in 2011. So she said I should. And then I didn't yet.
So
leave that hanging. But I developed this series. And actually, it was through my MFA program that I wrote the first novel. And then through my work with Dennis Rader, we were doing a documentary. And that's how I met Tracy Ullman, not the comedian, the producer. And she already knew Henley. So
I didn't know that.
Because she had done some research on the trafficking in Houston and Dallas during that time period when Henley and Brooks, the two accomplices, both told police it was going on and the police did not investigate. So she was doing an investigation. She had been talking to him. So how did this come full circle?
Yeah.
You know, so that was in, I think, 2021, so 10 years later. And suddenly I have this opportunity to talk to Henley. And then he became a consultant on the second novel.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
So
I just can't.
So there, it all came out of that ghost encounter, whatever it was.
Crazy. Well, I was going to ask you about that later in the episode, about how this transformed this novel into the number one show on HBO Max for a while. Like, how cool that it made it to that stage with Tracy.
Agree. And
awesome.
Didn't anticipate that. But the door opened and I just went, okay, it's time. It's
Yep.
time. I want to talk to him. This medium told me to talk to him.
Yeah, the
Yeah.
stars
Now
were
I
aligning.
now I will say I still have never heard from Danny Hansford.
Well,
So
maybe
whatever he
someday.
was trying to tell me, I
Yeah.
never heard what it was. But it made up a whole good story into a novel, and that was fun. But the thing is, it did happen in a real place, and a real medium did say that to me, and that ended up
Wow.
becoming several books for me and documentaries and all of that. It took a while, but
Yeah.
wow, for her to have said Candyman, I'm like,
That's so
what?
If that's not a sign, I don't
Of
know what
all
is.
things, usually
God.
mediums say, it's by water, it's under a bridge,
Yeah.
Candyman.
It's very specific.
Very
They're like, I'm
specific.
seeing an HBO doc. I think you. You're like, that's.
So
That's
I
crazy.
actually put this into the novels, probably not the fourth one, but the first three. I have these paranormal elements that I have actually experienced in my life. So when Annie, she can't just dismiss it all because things have happened, and she
Sure.
acknowledges things have happened. And so she still wants to piece through it. And like each of the novels ends with a debriefing with her team because one of them wants to see a ghost too. They kind of compete as to who's going to be the first one
He's
to
gonna
see a
catch him
ghost.
first, yeah.
Right. So you always get the explanation. There's always a little mystique, but still, we're not going to just jump to a ghost story if we can figure out what really happened here in a
Right.
different way. And so that's her job, and that's always been my job on our paranormal forensics team, because they will leap ahead with whatever the mediums are saying, and I hold back and go, but wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
But still, I'm open, I'm not dismissive. I don't want to just go, what, this can't exist, ghosts don't exist. I don't do that. But don't tell me you're smelling the tobacco from a Civil War battle. Oh, we did have one in Gettysburg where they had decided that they had two nurses with them during an evening, I don't know, investigation, and they smelled blood. So they knew it was from the battle. I'm like,
Yeah, okay.
what?
Yeah.
It could be a deer that got hit in the road. Honestly,
Right.
why do you think this is ghost blood, for God's
Yeah.
sake?
Down in New Orleans, they pull that stuff at the
They do.
Lafitte's blacksmith shop. They
Yes,
tell the story
they
about a
do.
pirate, and then all of a sudden you're like, so if you smell the cigar smoke, I'm not convinced they're not just pumping it in the HVAC, to be honest with
No,
you.
exactly.
Yeah.
Because just because you smell something, or you hear, or somebody, I think somebody said Pickett whispered in their ear from Pickett's Charge. I said, he didn't die here. Why is he whispering
Yeah,
in
why
your
would he
ear?
whisper there? Yeah.
Or we just went through a cold spot. Well, it's 20 degrees outside. There's a
Yeah.
lot of cold spots
Yeah.
here.
We're in the shade, so I don't
Yeah. So
know.
my job and Annie's job it has been, let's think about this now. You want to jump too quickly into a paranormal explanation, but there's other explanations, and so I'll first look for that, but I still will accept that odd things can happen because they have.
Are there any other places that you maybe want to include in a future project? Like any of the haunted places you haven't been to? Like I think the Vasilla Axe Murder House would be incredible to visit.
Yeah, but you know what? It's kind of a hokey right now because you can stay overnight as a ghost hunter, and
Yeah.
it's like a it's too touristy. It yields itself too much to the interest from ghost hunters and stuff. I if I were to go someplace, it would be more like a place that's unexplored, and that's really my entire authorship has been. I want to go where people haven't gone.
Yeah, are there places left that are unexplored?
Yeah, but I won't give them away.
Yeah, tell me, Catherine, if you had to list three places
Fair.
that
I just saw this article from the five places people in Florida don't want anyone to know about.
Yeah, and here they are.
Exactly. No,
Secrets
I know that
out.
there are places, and I'm more interested in, the fresh, the
Sure.
newness of something where people haven't been all over the place with cameras and recorders and whatnot. There's
Yeah.
when I first started with in Gettysburg with Mark, he was in the 1990s, so 30
Wow.
years ago, and you know there wasn't a lot of that stuff going on. It was before the ghost plumbers got their TV
Yeah,
show,
right.
and it was really people were just experimenting, and so we had free rein to do some interesting things. But now, my God, you know, every day there's people out there. It's overrun. So
Yeah.
I want to be in places where I can pioneer something or I can explore something that we don't have real clear answers on, you know. So
Ed mentioned it at the top, but one of the stories we covered this month was the Todville Murder Mansion or the Seabrook Murder Mansion. What is your take on that place? Because really, it was just one guy's hideous vision. But, and then he was just murdered in the very place that he kind of built out to live these dark fantasies.
He's interesting to me in part because this is just 10 years after Dean Corll in Houston did something similar. Because Dean Corll and this guy, Bill List was his name, they both brought boys to be tortured and, you know, abused and assaulted for their own pleasure. And Bill List kept the boys basically as prisoners. And Corll did that with some of them. He'd keep them for several days, and then he'd have his accomplices kill them and bury them. So in a way, it's weird because they're both close to Houston, and not too distant in time. I thought that was interesting. But it's the house that he built. It's a 34,000 square foot mansion overlooking.
Something.
You know, it was amazing, and it had bars in the windows. You know, it was really a prison. He would bring in these adolescent, and he had a prison record for, you know, assault of underage boys. He'd bring these boys in. Some of them were hustlers. Some of them were just you know, lawn boys, and he'd bring him into the house. The house is set up with an indoor pool and bars, and you know, it was very extravagant. And then he'd give them drugs and alcohol, similar to what Dean Corll did, the Candyman. And then they'd find themselves kind of trapped and living there. And some of them probably wanted to live there. Maybe they were runaways and homeless, but you know, some of them didn't. And then I think four of them decided, it was at 1984, I think that was the year.
I think so, yeah.
Four of them ganged up on him and shot him and took his car and took his credit cards and, you know, started going on a spending spree. And I think it's also interesting to note, again, with Dean Corll, he trained Elmer Wayne Henley, his second accomplice, how to shoot and shoot and shoot until your target goes down. And then when he rushed Wayne one night, Wayne just shot and shot and shot till Corll went down.
Wow. He
So
was dead,
in
yep.
a weird way, these two sadomasochistic men who would torture adolescent boys set up their own murders. Both of them did.
We had a somebody write in after that episode and they said that they're a DoorDasher. You know DoorDash, the food service? He said he's a DoorDasher in Seabrook, and every time he's near that place, which is what Melis Villas by the sea now, it's like but it's not
Yes,
the, that's what caught me off guard is that it's not the same. That place doesn't exist
right, it
anymore, but
doesn't.
the energy does. Like he said, I get this foreboding feeling every time I'm delivering down that area. So what's your take on the fact that the building is gone?
You'd have to ask somebody who doesn't know the history. Do they, if
True.
they have a feeling there? Because when you have foreknowledge of a place like Lizzie Borden's house, let's say, it's going to be creepy because you're going in with this knowing how awful this stuff
Right.
was.
What is that, confirmation bias, they call
Yeah,
it?
it's not like there
Yeah.
was a massacre in this house or anything,
Right.
but someone was murdered there and kids were tortured there and held captive. So if you go there, even though the house no longer exists, now Mark Nesbitt will have a different take on this because he thinks the land traps the memories.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
And that's what Mark wrote in Haunted Crime Scenes, and he's free to do that. He does a lot of that with the quartz grounding in Gettysburg, and you know what the houses sit on and all that. And that's, you know, that's a theory. But I think it's more psychological that, like, you'd have to have people who know nothing about the place. A number of them come back and say, "Oh my God, when I walked over there, it was so weird."
Yeah, and probably on their own accord too. You couldn't
Yeah.
even stand them there and be
Yeah.
like, "Tell us if you feel anything," because then you're
Yeah, and
probably thinking,
if you do that, then you've already set them up.
You're right,
So
right.
if you want conditions, so back to science, if you want conditions where you really want to test, is it the ground that holds these things, these vibes, or is it this the projection because of foreknowledge? And there would have to, and you could collect reports. Like you could set something up where, people who walk through an area, you ask them to write down, "Oh, what did you see? What did you know?" And if they had felt something odd, they would maybe say something. But it's very hard to set up, and it's very hard to collect. It's very subjective. But I still think most of the evidence would be people have a sense when they go to a place they already know, so they're expecting to feel creepy. And sometimes a house is the architecture is creepy in itself.
Sure, it just lends
But
to it.
when you know that there's been an event in a house that already had a weird reputation because it had bars on the windows, and it was a huge house. And he
Huge,
was
like
a man with a twisted past. So, in my opinion, when people say it's creepy there, it's because they're already thinking about the stuff that happened there.
I agree
Right.
personally.
So another place we talked about this month was the Dozier School in Florida, which is that horrible, air quotes, reform school where 51 of these young men and boys were confirmed to have lost their lives, and they're still using DNA and genetic genealogy in hopes of matching names to these victims. But when it comes to haunting, do you think it matters if one person lost their life at a crime scene or dozens? Like, it's not like,
It's not a
does it matter the
multiplier.
number of people?
I don't even think they need to have lost their lives. If they had severe trauma at a site, it could be trapped there in a way.
What could be trapped there, though?
The intense energy of their emotions. And that's what we think of on battlefields, because they didn't all die there, but they were in the most extreme fear, and their bodies are highly charged with adrenaline, and so we sometimes see sites being haunted by someone that did not die there. And so
Interesting.
why would they be here unless it was a highly emotional place for them, an attachment of some kind? But I don't, I mean, that now you're I mean I'm not even saying I believe in ghosts. I'm saying I'm open to it. But now for me to try to explain that, I don't know the truth about it at all. I just know that we have stories of places where apparitions or orbs or whatever get captured, where the person didn't die there. So then what? So it isn't necessarily about a death, but if you do have like one death that was, and I think emotionality is part of this, because there's plenty of people who die in places and the place doesn't get any kind of vibes. But I think that they're, especially battlefields, places where people have been tortured, seem to have this kind of aura about them. And that school in particular, because the kids were treated so horribly. I mean, they would whip them with spiked paddles, for no reason, no matter, some were as young as 5 years old, and no apparent reason why they should be punished. They would be whipped till they passed out, and they were put in dryers, large dryers, and some died that way. There's evidence at least one kid was shot because a bullet was picked up out of the grave. So you have a collective trauma there. I think that kind of energy will, manifest there.
Dozier, to me, the second we started digging into that story, it reminded me of something that was in our own backyard, and that's Pennhurst Asylum. I live 10 minutes from Pennhurst at this point. And for those who aren't local, it's basically a hospital that were for people who are physically and mentally challenged that closed in the 70s due to complete mistreatment. But have you ever explored Pennhurst, and what are your feelings about this place? Cool. Well, I ask because I have mixed feelings. I see the value in marketing this place because it's now a haunted house.
Yeah.
I appreciate the fact that they're bringing money in for the preservation, but I also know people who had family members there that were patients, and to see them capitalize on the things that went on there doesn't sit well with me. Like, I just took my kids a few weeks ago and they have one room that it's like zombie mental patients jumping out at you. And there's, it's kind of messed up because that's actually what happened there. So when does fascination cross the line into exploitation?
Yeah, I went there. I was teaching a class on the psychology of fear. And one of my students arranged for us to do an overnight at Pennhurst for her project.
Wow.
No thanks.
And, my goodness.
And you know, it was a really a study in psychology because they allowed us, I think, into two buildings. Now, you can't go into any old building at Pennhurst. They're very, you know, certain ones are meant for these occasions. And well, you go into one room and people are trying out, you know, a Frank's box or a, you know, recorders or the dowsing rods, you know, whatever it is. And depending on their mental state and what they're hoping, you can hear them saying what they're experiencing and, you know, the voices they're hearing and the words they're making out, et cetera. But those who went in, who went just because they're part of the class, but they weren't really that open to it, you know, are dismissing everything. So you really get that whole, the psychology of all of it, you know, if you go from room to room, which I did. And I never felt the vibes of, you know, the hair standing up in the back of my head, my neck, or, but then, you know, I'm a ghost repellent, so we have to put that into perspective too.
Right.
But it was very clear to me, the ones who really wanted to hear something did, you know, they had experiences, and the ones who really were skeptical had nothing.
But what's your take on turning that place into like a sideshow?
Well, and that was that all happened before they did this, but I think they started by having these, they brought together vendors before they did the haunted house. And then they realized that there was something lucrative to be had here. Who's going to raise money to restore the buildings?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of the problem is there it's a huge ground full of all these crumbling old buildings.
Yeah.
So either you're going to have to raise them all and build something else there, like condos or something.
Well, they're talking about making it a data center. I read an article.
No.
Oh, God. Yep.
Everything's going to be a data center.
I know.
And then AI is going to realize human beings are terrible for the earth. And they're going to dump us all. So they're going to eliminate us. Then there'll be a lot of ghosts around, but nobody will be
kidding.
Around to do anything about it. So I get why it's offensive. But I also get why they need to do something to raise money.
Yeah.
And so what else will it be? Who's going in there except people who want to be creeped out?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess they could do a tasteful haunted house, but who wants that anymore?
And they do. The historical tours of Pennhurst are just as interesting to me as the actual haunted house, because so the haunted house, they have one called the catacombs now, like one thing. And you actually get to go in the tunnels that ran underneath the buildings, which that is fascinating to me, too. Just seeing parts of Pennhurst that you can't see from the street.
But it doesn't raise enough revenue to people who are historically interested. It's just not enough people to do that.
No.
They only run the haunted house for what? A limited time, right?
6 weeks, 8 weeks.
So, you know, I guess I don't care if it's a way to raise money for, and yes, it's offensive to families, but so many things that we do are offensive to families of victims.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to stop doing it? No.
No.
I mean, there are people who would say a podcast about crime is offensive to families of victims.
A lot of people do.
So are you going to stop? Probably not.
So, no, because right. our goal, we're telling these victim stories. That's our contribution, is to get these names out there as much as we possibly can, so their memories aren't forgotten.
But they might also say, "But you're also being exploited." They would say all the time.
Yeah.
I'm writing books, so I'm being exploited. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how things work. You want to be as tasteful as you can about it, and as respectful as you can be. But I kind of understand their point of view, that how else are we going to raise money to keep these buildings, you know, patched up?
Mm-hmm. Well, with the whole dark tourism, because that's been huge for years and people love to visit these places where these tragedies happen, do you feel like there's a therapeutic value in visiting sites of tragedies? And do you think that there's any particular places that should be off limits?
Well, you know, some of these places get burned down by neighbors.
So, yeah.
Like H.H. Holmes.
Yes.
Castle and Ed Gein's farmhouse and mm-hmm. Jeffrey Dahmer's building has been, so some of these places, people take it into their own hands and say, we're tired of tourism. Do I think it's therapeutic? No. I don't see any therapeutic value for visiting and ogling a place where things happen, but it's interesting and fascinating. Certainly I do go to places that if I'm writing about them, I want to experience. Like when I'm writing about Dennis Rader's victims, I went in the places I want and saw what would be their experience of being cornered in this tiny room, or so that helps me as a writer to understand what they went through. Is it therapeutic? No.
I'm glad you said that, because doing these crime shows, when I'm writing a pitch or I'm starting to dig into a story in a new town that I've never been to, I feel like writing it is difficult. But then when I get on the ground, it all clicks and the story comes together. Yeah, because you're seeing the dynamic, you're understanding the community, you're understanding how something like this would affect a community like that. So there's nothing better than being on the ground in the place you're talking about to understand. I agree.
Yeah. Like even if, you could read about Bill List's mansion, but seeing it in pictures and videos is something else. Going to where it stood and the view he had. And again, that adds grounding to it. It situates you so that you do experience something, but I still wouldn't say it's therapeutic. It just helps you. That's why people go to battlefields. Same thing.
I want to
experience who thought going a mile across Pickett's charge was going to work. When you see it, when you experience it, you learn things.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely learn
Fact.
Things. Like you went to Salem. Wow.
Yeah.
That there's something about being in that cemetery and seeing the architecture of the houses, walking those streets. It's just, why not go do it if you can? I think it brings history alive to us.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't agree more. Well, I want to go off topic a bit, because there was something you said a minute ago that it's been on my mind lately, and maybe yours too, and that's AI, artificial intelligence. Because do you ever worry as a writer that your skills may become obsolete at some point? Like, do you believe that no matter how insightful you are, how good of a writer, storyteller you are, that you'll be phased out? I know it's terrifying, because the stuff that I used to take a week to write, you can pop in the criteria into one of these programs and it spits it out in seconds.
I already think I'm phased out.
Yeah, it's sad.
And that's one of the reasons I decided to retire from full-time teaching. I still teach at the graduate level, but I know students can replicate things in AI and make it so that you can't really tell if they're learning anything or not. And why aren't they driven by curiosity? I don't know. Right. I guess if they're not, then you can't really instill it in them.
It's a laziness, I think.
I don't know if it's laziness or just what they were exposed to growing up.
Look at
how they were spoon-fed things. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's their fault, is what I'm saying. Right. But I don't know that you can overcome it. And AI is just making it easier for them to fall back on. With our human brain, it takes the path of least resistance. It's it's lazy by default. You have to work at it if you want your brain to really produce things, especially being creative. And it's just easier to let other things do the stuff for you. And I don't know. I know that it has affected my desire to write. I watched one of my books, so it came out, I won an award, and all of a sudden there were five other people slapping their name on my material and selling it on Amazon. And they can do that. And how do you chase around making them take it down?
It's to the point where I could literally be like, here are upload 20 articles from Katherine Ramsland. Study this style and print and write for me a story about X, Y, and Z, and it'll sound like you wrote it.
Well, I tell you what, when Wikipedia first started, they just sucked up every article I'd written for the Crime Library, which is over 200, just took everything without attribution, everything.
Awful.
That's where it started.
Well, and I'm at the point where I'm like you're older than me. Not n no, I'm not saying it any kind of
Yes,
way.
I
I'm just saying like so even me, like I'm a dinosaur in this world right now, and I'm doing everything I can to learn AI, and it's overwhelming, and it feels icky to me, and I don't it makes me not want to do this anymore.
And that's why I'm on the horse farm. Because I don't have to think about this stuff anymore if I don't want
I
to.
know. Well, so talk about your branching out into just something you actually want to do, and you can leave all of this behind. Like, what are you up to these days?
And I'm not leaving it all behind. I'm just not putting so much of my life and effort into writing and writing, knowing how easily it can be replicated by somebody else, and they can take my work and say it's theirs. So that tends to demotivate fast. But I had the opportunity to assist with a horse in need who was lame, and he became my project, and it was on a little horse farm. Something I wanted ever since I was a little kid. I begged my mother multiple times to put me on a horse farm so I could just be with the horses. And here's another ghost story. Because when she died in 2020, and it was during COVID, and so we received the ashes curbside like pizza. It was horrible. And I was holding her ashes, and I said to my sister, "There goes my horse farm, because she's not going to do that for me now." And the next year, the woman who owns this horse farm broke her foot, and I started helping her and helping her. And then she gave me Sonny the Palomino as my project. And I went, "Oh my God, my mother broke your foot to give me my horse farm."
See, there are good ghosts, right?
Because I said that over her ashes, and she probably went, "Oh,
Oh, that's
that's what I thought."
crazy.
She's like, "I got you. Don't worry. Just
No
wait a year. I got
worries.
you."
But Sunny was on the verge of maybe being put down, because she now with her broken foot, she wasn't going to be able to work with him.
Yeah, that's a death sentence sometimes.
So Sunny and I needed each other at the right time, and now he's my love, my heart horse, as they say.
He's got two books too. I mean, he's
He's
a
got two
published
books. Yeah,
author.
he started bugging me about the fact that I'm an author and I could do these things for him. My favorite is the Sherlock horse, the Palomino PI.
So good.
I love that.
Oh my gosh, Catherine. Well, one of the other thing I wanted to bring up in conversation, because I actually had this conversation with a mutual friend of ours who we can talk about off camera, but the way information is presented when it comes to these true crime cases, and I'm saying this because Melissa and I are both very lighthearted people. Like when you're doing a podcast, you need to balance letting your personality shine through with factual, compassionate storytelling. And I feel like we do joke in some of these episodes, but it is never, ever, 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 ever about the victims. It's you can attest there's ridiculous things that happen in cases that are just sometimes comical. Like there's a especially when you deal with death day in and day out. So do you believe there's room for like gallows humor in certain aspects of these stories?
To some extent, I do, because there are things that are ironic and amusing, but I really hate the I go to I guess I have such a stressful day that I have to relax to a serial killer documentary. I mean, that to me is like you relax to people getting murdered. And I've even had to ask people, don't put this stuff on my Facebook page. I don't want people thinking I have this such disrespect for victims and what has happened to them. So some of the jokes I think are really just in such poor taste and so thoughtless. It's not the same as if you're on a forensics team and you've exhumed somebody and and the skeletal head goes rolling away. You know what I mean? Like I remember once we exhumed somebody and it was right around Halloween time and we had to roll the casket away from the lab into someone's garage, and some kids came up and they're asking, did we have candy inside? So it was funny, but that's not like finding humor in people being murdered, and that's what I guess I get appalled by that, and I try to ask people, please don't put that on any of my social media stuff because I don't want victims' families thinking this is how I feel. I don't laugh at that stuff, and I just don't join in with it. So I guess so. There's a line to be drawn. I don't know where it is, but I didn't think there's a line to be drawn.
It's so hard because there are just things that, like, Melissa and I, if we're not talking about crime or anything, we'll just joke at each other. Most of the jokes are just toward each other or something. And we had this conversation with a death investigator. It was last month or the month before. Just because she worked, so she saw death 24 hours a day. And I feel like you want to hear these stories as if you're in a room with friends.
And I get that, and I don't know how to advise you on what's proper decorum for something like that. I just know I don't use a lot of levity with the forensic stuff I do because I just think so much of it's really serious. I mean, trauma and
It's
rape
it is.
and that. But I find ways to get away from it. I don't know.
Well,
I understand the humor, but I also know some of it is in really poor taste.
Well, and there are podcasts that they make a living making fun of these things, and that it's like, how is this accepted in a society?
Yeah, and I don't like the ones that make fun of true crime fans. That's a whole nother thing. There was a whole podcast on trashing true crime fans. I just don't think there's a place for that.
No, I agree.
It's odd when it's, you're a true crime fan, but it's not that you're a fan. It's that I always like I love reading your crime library just because I think it's so fascinating to learn about these people and what makes someone's brain tick.
It is, yeah.
It's weird to be, oh, well, I'm really into true crime. Like, obviously, I don't like them, but I like learning about them, I guess,
Yeah.
is the best way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because the parameters of this are so fuzzy, it's hard to really have a discussion about it. I think the stuff that's really irreverent. And I see it on there's memes on Facebook that are like in such poor taste involving murder and serial killers, and so I just try to avoid it.
Well, I have one last question.
Oh.
Ed said he met you when he was your landscaper.
I
How did this
wasn't
happen?
gonna say anything.
That's true.
No, I think we met. He was a cameraman. It
I
was
was a
that.
pro I was like a producer. I mean, I was
Yeah,
setting
you
up
were part
crime
of
shows.
the production team, and I think maybe we were filming in my house because I was using my house a lot. I don't
I don't know
remember.
how it came up. We were because we lived 5 minutes apart at the time.
Then yeah, he started, and I had a small yard, but I needed some things done that I couldn't do, and he came and helped with the landscaping. Yes,
I
that's how I knew.
did.
I wasn't going to say so, but yes,
I
it's
love
true. He
it.
was
I
good at it.
remember my most vivid memory. We had to build these steps going down to like a garden or something. I was
Yes,
throwing 4x4s down, and like I didn't really know what I was
the
doing, but I was
bench,
like
the
handy
stone
enough.
benches. Yeah. Oh, that house was haunted.
Was it really? The one in Fountain Hill? Oh my God.
I never saw anything, but everybody else did.
Wow. All I saw were the bees that I uncovered under the ground and got stung.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I had that happen several times there. But I had experience there. Now, the guy who built the house had built it for his, I think, son and daughter-in-law, and he got killed in an elevator accident.
Wow.
When I first bought the house, I stood in an empty living room, and it was set up so that when the doors open, a chime rings. The front door was on, I was in my sight, the back door was locked, and I heard the chime, and these doors aren't opening. But then my parents came to stay, and my father, the second morning after, he said, why are you on your computer at night? I said, what are you talking about? He was down in the, my bedroom was upstairs, and he was down in the hallway. And he said, when I go past your office, there you are, but your hair's braided.
Oh my gosh.
And he did not stay.
He was gone.
Wow. He's not going to stay another night. He said, I've seen you two nights in a row.
I'm all set.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I actually had a police officer. He was one of the local detectives. He lived across the street from me. And in fact, he's my computer consultant in the novels. And he was sitting on the deck looking into down that hallway, that very same hallway. And the light, he jumps out of it. Someone's in your house.
Nope. No, thank you. Nope.
Oh.
Many people, I never experienced stuff, but many other people did.
You really, really are funny. Repellent. You're the ghost repellent.
I know. I don't want to be.
Oh, man, Catherine. Well, before we let you go, I want to give our audience a little treat for Halloween. So we thought it would be fun to play a little game with you if you're up for it. So we do this with all of our guests as a fun way to end a serious discussion and kind of a little palate cleanser before we spent the whole month talking about such awful things. So what do you think? You down?
Sure.
Cool. Well, we have devised a game which is going to pit you against yourself called Name That Nightmare. So you have written, a bajillion books? And in this game, we will read you a quote from one of those books, and you will need to name the book or the haunted location which these lines refer to.
Come on, I'm old. I don't have memory anymore.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a Murder Unscripted sticker pack on the line.
Ooh,
so you better rack that brain of yours. So, Catherine Ramsen, are you ready to play Name That Nightmare?
I'm ready.
Okay, round one. Here is the quote. Obsession leaves its fingerprints long after the body is gone.
That's all? Can I get more? Obsession leaves its fingerprint.
I will tell you, it's kind of discussing compulsion becoming the haunting, psychological residue becomes forensic evidence.
Well, that could be haunted crime scenes. Or ghost.
It was The Forensic Psychology of Criminal Minds from 2011.
I said that? Or did somebody say that as a character?
You said that. No, you said that.
That's a great line.
Holy cow.
That's a great line.
I have written many millions of words.
I know. That's why we're trying to stump you.
I don't think I would have gotten that one. Because that book I wrote so fast, and I had so little actual investment in that book. It was more an editor wanted it. So.
Oh, I got it. All right, well, we started with a hard one. That's okay. They'll get easier.
That's a hard one.
All right, so round two.
Oh, no.
Okay. There's five questions.
Oh, all right.
Okay. He built a life that divided perfectly in two, one visible and one buried.
He built a life that divided perfectly. Buried. It sounds like Dennis Rader, but I don't know if it's from Confession of a Serial Killer.
That
did I say
correct.
Buried? I'm surprised that I said
you
that.
Did.
Buried, yes.
Okay, Dennis Rader, Confession of a Serial Killer.
Good job. What was it like to write that one? Because that was one of your most heavily analyzed
5 years.
Cases. Yeah.
Wow.
5 years. And I didn't, no book took 5 years.
Wow.
It was a tough book. In fact, I'm writing it's one chapter in my memoir of what was it like to visit him, to explore the murder sites under his direction, and look at police reports that he had marked up with all kinds of stuff. Yeah, that was a, and I still talk to him. I've been talking to him for 15 years now.
Wow. Melissa's fascinated by that case. The
Yeah.
Raider.
I
Me
imagine
too.
that's got to get heavy. Even some of these cases, we only cover for a couple weeks, and I'm like so mentally and physically and emotionally drained by just that one.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even imagine you doing it 5 years. That's
Yeah,
incredible.
and then we did a 4-part documentary for A&E
Yeah.
on that. So
Remember
back
that.
into that world I went for 2 years.
Wow.
And then he got suspected in these cold cases. So suddenly I'm back involved in all of that as well. And
Wow.
he's been part of my life for 15 years. Yeah.
It's crazy.
right. Well, apparently we should have made these a little longer because they're pretty hard. So
Well,
round
that did sound
three.
like Raider, but I wondered why I said buried, because I don't think he buried
No.
it. But,
Well,
I'm not much
yeah.
of a poet.
Round three. In every solved case hides another question still breathing under the surface.
Gosh, that could be so many of them. That could be the science of cold case files. That could be forensic science of CSI.
It was the Devil's Dozen, how cutting-edge forensics
Oh
took
my
down
God, I forgot
12
I wrote
notorious serial
that.
killers. I think you gave me a copy of that 20 years
But they
ago.
reissued it. But
Yeah, they
when I first
reissued like
wrote it,
with a new
that
cover.
was back, because I had done a history of serial killers. And from that, I got, and I had done a history of forensic science. So from that, I got the 12 cases where the two crossed. But I'd still
Gotcha.
say the Devil's Dozen. It's probably here on my shelf somewhere,
That's
but
a great
that
I
has
read
to
that. That's a
be
great
that
one.
that's years ago. I wouldn't have even
Yeah.
remembered the
We should have asked you the title. Name the title of this book.
I'm losing.
It's okay.
Number four, between science and superstition lies the space where curiosity turns dangerous.
Again, that could be so many.
I pulled just a soundbite. I should have pulled a couple sentences, and I'm sorry for setting you up.
That sounds like paranormal forensics, or
The science of vampires.
Paranormal and forensics in that book. That's a
Do you
whole
remember that one?
chapter
Yeah.
with the FBI. I got Robert Ressler to do that chapter with me. Yeah,
Wow. Because that's
yeah.
kind of what about the how the rational mind like flirts with the
Yeah.
myth to like explain the unknown, right?
You guys are showing that I have dementia.
All this game is exposing your health issues. right, last one just for fun. Some places do not forget. They replay their worst moments for anyone willing to listen. This is something you do a lot in your writing to me. It explores the notion of treating hauntings like case files, where emotion is the evidence.
Well, because I think it's that's true.
Yeah.
That sounds like ghost, but it sounds like a lot of the things that I wrote that have that
Yeah.
paranormal edge to it.
All right. Well, that was Blood and Ghosts, Haunted Crime Scene Investigations with Mark Nesbitt.
Well, I said paranormal, that's paranormal
Yes,
forensics.
that
And I
counts,
said
yeah,
that for
it did.
another one, so you can just tape it onto that one.
Yeah, we'll just flip it around and be like 5 for 5. We figured
Perfect. Well, I got
it
confession of a serial killer. And the only
Yes,
thing
you did.
that tripped me up on that one was, did I say buried?
I thought it was because he buried some of the mementos he kept
Yeah, he
or
did.
something. So that's where I that's why
Yeah.
I thought he said buried.
It could be.
Well, sorry that was so hard. I
The
should have made
mind of a writer. I mean,
it.
I will tell you, I don't go back and reread my stuff once it's published, hardly at all,
Yeah.
unless I have to for like I right now, because I'm doing my memoir, I have to go back and read some of it. But mostly my mind is moving into the next
I get
project.
that. Totally
I
get that.
think I've read your Devil's Dozen book so many times, it's like starting to fall apart because I have a paperback version.
And actually, I'll tell you, I didn't realize that I've been a writer for a long time without aspiring to be so, because when I started doing this memoir, I found my journal of when I hitchhiked across the country. I couldn't believe I kept a journal. My sister reminded
Wow.
me that I did. And there, so there's everything laid out. And then I started talking to the first suspected serial killer. He was only convicted of one, but he was suspected in multiple. My first one, I wrote long letters to him. So I have all kinds of stuff documented from these letters. Because I,
Wow.
like, my God, I've been a writer for a long time.
Forever, yeah. That's great. That's so cool, though. I mean,
That's
how
so
awesome.
cool.
Yeah.
Catherine, seriously, thank you so much for joining
Yes,
us. This
thank
was
you.
awesome. It was so great to
I
have
had a
you. It
great
was
time.
nice. Good. It was nice catching up with you again after all these years. I know you're stepping back a little bit, but maybe our paths will cross again before you
Yeah,
hang
you
it up
know how
for
many
good.
years I've been waiting to be on your show? I'd like you
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we said that last week. We said of all your accomplishments, this is probably the one that you've just been looking
Absolutely, the
for.
pinnacle of your career.
No, I keep pushing other people. Oh, you should be on this show. And then are they going to call me
And we pushed you off because we had things fall into our lap, and we work in these monthly themes, so it was
Yeah.
just we wanted to find the right theme for you and not just throw you in to
Yeah,
throw you in.
no,
So that was all.
paranormal forensics. In fact, make sure that you say something about the novels, because that is me and many of the cases that I worked on.
It has been wonderful. I've been a huge fan of yours, and you kind of touched on this at the beginning, but I think the reason I've always been such a big fan of yours is because, like you said, you were always one of the only women on these crime shows that I remember watching for years and years and years. And I always remember thinking that was so cool. It's like when you see a woman doing a job like a firefighter or something, it's like it's almost like your own like action hero, because you're doing something that's so not normal, I guess. And I just always thought you were so cool to be doing this when it was such a crazy field. And it's almost like the final girl in the serial killer movies, where it's like the cute, adorable blonde girl beats the big bad Freddy Krueger.
And here's my forensic Barbie.
Hey, super cool.
That's so cool.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And you just reinforced why they kept coming back to me for documentaries.
Yes, you're
Yep.
like the ultimate final girl.
The one who doesn't go alone in the basement.
Exactly.
Because you're smart. All right,
Thank
Catherine,
you.
we'll talk soon.
All right.
Thank you.
What'd I tell you? Down to earth, right?
Oh, she's the best.
It's awesome.
I have always liked her, and kind of like what she said at the beginning, she was always one of the only females being interviewed on these true crime shows, which I always thought was so cool.
And I don't think about that stuff. Like when she brought that up, I'm like, you know what? You're right. It's just something that never, maybe it's because I'm a guy. Maybe it's because I was just so immersed in other, like every story I'm in that I just never even paid attention to it. But it's interesting.
Yeah, and I just feel like I always looked up to her because of that, because she was doing something different and just so interesting to me.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I think it was a great way to end our October block, our spooky season block, talking about haunted crime scenes with the queen of creep, Catherine
Yeah,
Ramsey.
right? The
Yeah.
patron saint of murder and scripted.
Right? Whether she knows it or not.
Whether she knows it or not, exactly. Well, we have big things coming up next month. We actually have a really cool theme that I've been excited about since we started this show, not even knowing we were going to do it, but hoping.
Yeah.
We won't announce our guest just yet, but we can tease our theme.
Sure.
We are going to be focusing on forensic sketch artists in a theme called Drawn to Justice.
That is correct. And I think it's going to be a unique element of true crime that we haven't really explored yet.
Yeah, and if you guys out there have any cool jobs in this industry or have any ideas about themes, give us a hard theme that we have to like figure out cases for.
Yeah,
Like
they're all
that's
hard.
always, well, I'm saying like give us a theme that we really have to dig. That's my favorite, like trying to find cases that'll fit in our themes.
And I love doing ones that nobody knows about. I mean, I
Yes.
feel like in this oversaturated world of true crime that we live in, that every story has been done by everybody because everybody has a podcast now. But every now and then we'll throw in one that is lesser known.
Absolututely. I love the lesser
Yeah,
known. So if you
agreed.
have any, send them to us, and you know where you can find us. But I will remind you, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Blue Sky at Murder Unscripted. We have a Reddit, so you can absolutely hit us up on there. Just search for Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, Or you can even send us your thoughts through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
That is correct. All the places.
All the places. So until next week, when we start our new theme and our new month, be safe, stay hydrated, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No, they do not. No perverts in this episode, just a bunch of ghosts.
Maybe you, little perv.
Wow, that's nice.
Goodbye. Yeah.